I had a conversation on the phone just last evening with a man who I've known for many years. In fact, we became friends when we were in college here at the University of Florida, and we were both involved with CRU, formerly known as Campus Crusade for Christ. And he is an elder in the church that he attends in another city here in the state. And I have worshipped or been in his church a couple of times over the years. And the last time I was there, I noticed there was a change from what I had remembered in the church, because one of the first times I was ever in his church, there was beautiful stained glass windows on the sides, and then up behind the pulpit was a big stained glass window that was a representation of Jesus. And that stained glass window is no longer there. It has been replaced with a stained glass window that has a depiction of an open Bible. And so I was talking with him last night and asking him to remind me why they switched out the stained glass windows. And he went on to explain that their pastor and the elders had been discussing it over some period of time, and in light of the second commandment in the Ten Commandments, they felt that having a likeness of Jesus was violating the second commandment, which is the commandment we're going to be looking at today. I have yet another friend. In fact, he's a man that I married him and his wife back in the 80s, and he also serves as an elder in his church, and yet a different church in a different city in the state. And they were a church plant, and for several years were doing what we're doing now, rented the facilities of other places. And then finally, they raised enough funds to buy an abandoned old congregational church. Big old brown brick church had been sitting there empty for years. And so they've moved in, and they've refurbished it, and Priscilla and I have worshipped there even in the last couple of years. And it has beautiful stained glass windows. And the pastor that I know casually told me after the service, the last time I was there, I said, "You know, you've done a beautiful job of refurbishing this building." And he said, "Yes, but, you know, we need to get rid of the stained glass windows. We just don't have the money to do it." And it's because there are depictions of God the Father and of God the Son, Jesus, in these windows. And so that is not unusual. There are some segments of the Christian church that have currently, as well as historically, believed that the second commandment forbids God's people from having any kind of an artistic or material or physical representation of either God the Father or Jesus the Son. Mentioning Project Hungary, as Ed did before he prayed for the offering, I've been to Hungary a few times, and on one visit, our host took us down to an area there in downtown Budapest that is known as Hero Square. And they have erected in this park-like setting all these statues to various people who have been famous in the history of the Hungarian nation. And then there's one statue that was there for a couple of decades, but which was torn down once the Iron Curtain fell in 1989. And the statue that was torn down was a statue of Stalin from the old Soviet Union. And the thing that was kind of ironic is they replaced the statue of Stalin, and where it sat, what is there now, is a public bathroom. I mean, talk about going from pinnacle to porta potty. That's a pretty good fall, you know. But, you know, that change, that very kind of thing happened in the Old Testament. And before we look at the second commandment in Exodus 20, I want to ask you to turn with me to another Old Testament book, the book of 2 Kings. 2 Kings chapter 10. And for the sake of time, if you would permit me, I'd like to just kind of give you a very brief historical context rather than reading a lot of the historical narrative. But it has been almost 100 years since the kingdom of Israel, after the death of Solomon, had a civil war and they split and became the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. And the southern kingdom was often called Judah. And each had their own set of kings. And as I said, about 100 years after this split, the king of the northern kingdom by the name of Jehu came to the throne, and he decided that it was time to try and correct the erroneous path that the northern kingdom had taken, in that they had actually allowed, as Israelites, the worship of one of the pagan gods, Baal, to take place within the northern kingdom. And so Jehu, in a very insidious, which is actually the literal translation of the word that appears in the Hebrew text, he, in a very cunning fashion, announced that he wanted to have one big super-duper worship service for Baal, and urged every single Baal worshiper in the kingdom to come to this big convocation. So they all gathered in one place, and Jehu actually went through the motions of burning incense and making an offering to the god Baal. And the way 1 Kings chapter 10 unfolds the story for us, unbeknownst to the worshipers inside, he had asked 80 of his strongest military men to gather outside the building. And when the worship service, as it were, concluded, these 80 men descended upon all the Baal worshipers and executed them. If you look with me in 2 Kings, as I said, chapter 10, having given you that little brief overview, no wonder it's not making sense to me. I'm in 1 Kings. 2 Kings, chapter 10. Picking up with verse 26, after they had executed all those worshipers, and it says in verse 26 that they, being the officers and his soldiers, brought out the sacred pillars of the house of Baal and burned them. They also broke down the sacred pillar of Baal and broke down the house of Baal and made it a latrine to this day. So very similar to the Hero Square. I mean, we go from shrine to septic tank here, and the place where the worship of Baal was taking place. Maybe I could also throw in the alliteration, they went from temple to toilet, if that's not too crass. Now, it would seem from reading this account that Jehu was only zealously trying to return the northern kingdom back to a proper worship of God, removing the false idols in their midst, and following the teaching of the Ten Commandments, and especially Commandments 1 and 2. But if you haven't left 2 Kings just yet, I would direct your attention down to the word at the beginning of verse 29, however. However, as for the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he made Israel sin, from these Jehu did not depart, even the golden calves that were at Bethel and that were at Dan. So even though Jehu led some sort of a revival and removing the worship of Baal, there was something else in the country that he left untouched. Because when the civil war took place and Israel split into two kingdoms, the southern kingdom is where Jerusalem is located. And of course, that's where the temple is. This is where all the Jews come as the focal point of their worship of Yahweh, the one true God. So the northern kings began to get a little fidgety. Well, we don't want our people continuing to go back down to the southern kingdom to worship God, so we need to create some kind of an alternative place for people to worship so they're not tempted to go back to Jerusalem down in Judah. And then maybe they'll become more loyal to the southern king and they'll do away with me. Now, this is Richard Parker's Cliff Notes version here. I'm wrapping these things up very quickly for the sake of time. So what the northern king did at the time is he didn't deny that they would worship Yahweh. But what he did is he set up a place of worship in two cities, Dan and Bethel, the ones that are mentioned here in the text. And along with creating an alternative place of worship to Jerusalem, he built a golden bull or calf in each place, supposedly to represent strength and power and to kind of aid the people in their worship of God. Let's read verses 4 to 6 of Exodus 20, the second commandment. You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the water under the earth. You shall not worship them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing loving kindness to thousands to those who love me and keep my commandments. So not only is commandment one stated as we looked at it last week, not only were they to have no other gods before them, no God besides God himself, they are not to make an image not only of false gods, but they're not to be making an image in any form of Yahweh himself. Now in the Hebrew Old Testament, there are 14 different words that are translated in English as idol. And it's not that they're not distinctively different from one another, but they're synonyms. But the one that's used in Exodus chapter 20, verse 4 is the Hebrew word which simply means a carved piece of wood or stone. But we see that as Moses was given this second commandment, that it takes the reader beyond just the mere idol and says not even a likeness. So in our time together this morning on commandment number 2, I basically want to seek to answer three questions with you. One, what exactly is forbidden? Two, why is it forbidden? And three, what is the role of art and worship? What is forbidden? Well, most conspicuously, material images, objects made by human hands. Not only were they not to make them themselves as Israelites, but they were not to tolerate them within the land of Canaan. And there is great emphasis put on this prohibition. In fact, as soon as we conclude the recording of the Ten Commandments in verse 17, just a few verses later in this chapter 20, you come to verse 22, then the Lord said to Moses, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, you yourselves have seen that I have spoken to you from heaven. You shall not make other gods besides me, gods of silver or gods of gold. You shall not make for yourselves. So even after the Ten Commandments are recorded within a few verses, he goes back and reiterates and underscores this prohibition. If you would turn over just a number of pages to the book of Deuteronomy. After Exodus comes Leviticus, then Numbers, then Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy chapter 12, and this is just one example of numerous places where this instruction occurs. Starting in verse 1 of Deuteronomy 12, these are the statutes and the judgments which you shall carefully observe in the land which the Lord, the God of your fathers, has given you to possess, as long as you live on the earth. You shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations whom you shall dispossess serve their gods, on the high mountains and on the hills and under every green tree. Those were typically locations where pagan altars were built. Verse 3, and you shall tear down their altars and smash their sacred pillars and burn their asherim with fire, and you shall cut down the engraved images of their gods, and you shall obliterate their name from that place. You shall not act like this toward the Lord your God, but you shall seek the Lord at the place which the Lord your God shall choose from all your tribes to establish his name there for his dwelling, and there you shall come. They not only were forbidden from making these kinds of images themselves, they were to obliterate any others that were within the land. Why such an emphatic prohibition? Well, the Old Testament itself, in part, is a chronicle of their continual flirting with the neighboring gods and goddesses of their pagan neighbors. And the reason for this, though, really lies in the fact that there is an inclination of the human heart. In fact, right after the Ten Commandments, God gives Moses specific details about social and civil law in Exodus chapters 21 and 23. And then it culminates in Exodus chapter 24, where they have this grand day where they gather the Israelites together, and they have this formal public affirmation of the covenant of the law that God had given through Moses. And again, for the sake of time, in Exodus 24, if I could summarize, Moses sets up 12 stone pillars at the foot of Sinai, representing the 12 tribes of Israel. Moses sacrifices young bulls, and half the blood is put on the altar. Then in verse 7 of Exodus 24, which is the one I want to point out to you, then he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of all the people, and they said, and it appears in the text, they did this in unison, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do, and we will be obedient." So there's this collective corporate affirmation they're going to follow the commandments of God. Then Moses goes back up Mount Sinai. Could you turn to Exodus 32 just quickly, please? Exodus 32. You would think that after that inspiring, moving experience of them collectively chanting that they'll obey and follow these things, that they would have been devout in obeying the Ten Commandments all of their lives. But in Exodus 32, and we're only talking only 40 days later, it's only 40 days since they made this public affirmation with Moses, we come to Exodus 32. I'm going to assume that most of you are familiar with this, either from reading the text or seeing a movie. While Moses is up on the mountain, the people start getting antsy. Why is he taking so long? Where is he? They're getting kind of skittish. We haven't seen him for a long time. And so they go to Aaron, and they say, we need something to worship. And so what does Aaron do? Verses 1 to 5, it describes it. He asks everybody to take off their gold earrings, and they put it in a pot, and they melt it down. I think one of the greatest understatements in all of Scripture is that when Moses comes back down and says, "What have you done?" Aaron said, "Well, we put the gold into this fire, and out came this calf," you know, as if it just kind of happened. And so they created this golden calf, and they began dancing around and worshiping this calf. Again, not denying the existence of Yahweh, but this was supposedly helping to aid them and give them confidence to have some object to look at. In verse 19, it came about as soon as Moses came near the camp and he saw what was going on, he threw the tablets from his hands and shattered them at the foot of the mountain. That's the tablets with the Ten Commandments. And he took the calf which they had made and burned it with fire and ground it to powder and scattered it over the surface of the water and made the sons of Israel drink it. And the punishment comes in verse 28. So the sons of Levi did as Moses instructed, and about 3,000 men of people fell that day. The human heart, as one person coined it, is an idol factory. There's always that inclination towards idolatry of the human heart. Thus, this emphatic prohibition in commandment number 2. You know, it's worth noting that in antiquity, defeated nations, one of the things that would demoralize them and help to hasten their submitting themselves to some conquering foe was that if the conquering foe was to grab hold of their places of worship and their idols and their representations of their gods and goddesses and destroy them and drag them through the streets, it just demoralized them. No likeness, even for the purpose of worshiping the one true God, should be made as a focal point of worship. But it's more than just constructing or fashioning material images. It's also forbidding mental images. Having mental images that we entertain of God can be just as much a violation of the second commandment as representing Him by the work of our hands. Because see, as we begin to construct an image of God, even if we don't venture into the area of physically what He appears, but even in terms of His character, His nature, and His attributes, as we begin to reflect on these things, if we're not careful, we can form thoughts about God that can be distorted and false. We can actually conjure up an image of God that does not square with His person as presented to us in the Scriptures. The well-known theologian J.I. Packer, I appreciated so much his one comment in this regard when he said, "No statement starting, quote, 'This is how I like to think of God,' should ever be trusted." And it's not uncommon for people to do that. I like to think of God as the great architect. Or I like to think of God as my daddy and me sitting on his knee. Or I like to think of God as not as a judge, but as a friend. Usually such statements, while affirming perhaps one accurate thing about God, so often deny some other aspect of His character. Someone can concoct an image of God that he's the kind of God that would never let a 5-year-old die of cancer. And then the child does die, God does allow it. And then the person becomes angry with the image of God they have concocted in their own mind. When our thoughts of God are shaped by our own preferences, we come up with likenesses and images in our own hearts and minds. I thought it was a very captivating title when some years ago one of the campus ministries hosted a conference, and the title of the conference was something like, "We must stop worshiping the God we want and seek to worship the God who is." It's possible to violate the second commandment in just the machinations of our minds. But there's some other things we can say about why it is forbidden. And you can see I've provided for you there at least 4 reasons. And the first is that we shouldn't be making an image of God because God is a spirit. And the moment you start to fashion something physically that's supposed to represent the one true God, it inevitably brings with it certain finiteness, certain limitations. In that very well-known conversation that Jesus had with the woman at the well in John chapter 4, Jesus says to her, "An hour is coming and now is when the true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and truth. For such people the Father seeks to be His worshipers. God is spirit, and those who worship Him must worship Him in spirit and truth." In Deuteronomy chapter 4, you no need to turn there, I'll just read it to you. If you'd like to write down the reference, it's verses 10 through 12. But Moses, again, is saying, "Remember the day you stood before the Lord your God at Horeb, when the Lord said to me, 'Assemble the people to me that I may let them hear my words so they may learn to fear me all the days they live on the earth and that they may teach their children.' And you came near and stood at the foot of the mountain, and the mountain burned with fire to the very heart of the heavens, darkness, cloud, and thick gloom. Then the Lord spoke to you from the midst of the fire. You heard the sound of words, but you saw no form, only a voice." And so even there at the outset, it was being implanted in their understanding that God is not something physical or visual to look at, but He is a spirit. Now, sometimes we become confused because of the use of anthropomorphisms in the Bible, particularly the Old Testament. And an anthropomorphism, which comes from two Greek words, it's not a word that actually appears in the Bible, but it's from the word man and form. So there are times when, in order to communicate to us and understand better who God is and how He acts, sometimes human physical characteristics are attributed to Him, but they're not intended to be taken literally. And I think most of you know this. For example, in Numbers 12, when it says the Lord with Moses spoke mouth to mouth, well, that doesn't mean that God literally, physically had a mouth. Or in Joshua, He refers to the hand of the Lord. Or in Job, where He says, do you have an arm like God? Well, it's not that you can look on God and He's there with two guns that you can just look at. Rather, this is just something to help us understand. We associate arm with strength and with protection. And God is a God of strength and protection. And so to describe Him as having an arm is one way that that communicates to us. In fact, I heard one very distinguished theologian. It's kind of like God talking to us in baby talk, like we do with our kids, until they get old enough to really understand. So it's forbidden because we shouldn't be preoccupied with anything physical because God is a spirit. But it's also forbidden because of the imagination of man. I've already talked about the fact that we can mentally concoct wrong images of God. But when you think about it, there is no image that we can create that is not going to ultimately be so far beyond, excuse me, so far below what really represents the true God. If I could quote J.I. Packer one more time this morning, not only can we not imagine Him adequately, since He is at every point greater than we can grasp, we dare not trust anything our imagination suggests about Him. For the built-in habit of fallen minds is to scale God down. And what was the sin that Adam and Eve, why were they susceptible? Because the serpent said to them, you can be like God. And that was an appealing thought to them. And the effect of our wanting to be on God's level is that we end up dragging Him down to ours. I was reading one pastor who made the comment that even as nature abhors a vacuum, so does the human soul. And that human beings created in the image of God that we must worship, we will worship. And then this pastor went on to observe that the human soul will find an object of worship either on the shelf, on the altar, in the mirror, or in heaven. We are born idolaters. But also I would add these thoughts. Man-made images, whether material or mental, at the end of the day, obscure God's glory. It may reveal certain aspects of His character, but they hide others. I mentioned the golden calf that they built at the foot of Mount Sinai. That golden calf, as was often the case with bulls and calves, is that this was a strong animal, it was a powerful animal, and they, when they built them, they saw that as a symbol of power and strength. But what did that image convey about purity or holiness or moral excellence? Material and mental images also have a way of localizing God, and that people start to begin to think that somehow God is only represented, but He actually is there in relationship to that statue or that painting. When Paul was giving his sermon at Mars Hill, there in Athens, one of the statements he makes to them is God doesn't dwell in temple made by human hands. We should never kind of associate God with being in just one locale. And that's why so many Roman Catholics, I think, struggle with this, because the teaching of the church, and you know this, that there are many places where either people have had visions or certain pools of water that supposedly have healing powers, and people make pilgrimages and travel thousands of miles. They cross continents to go to a certain place because they've been taught or led to believe that somehow if you go to this place, God is there in a special way, in a way that he's not here where you live. If we're not careful, we start to treat these images and likenesses like some kind of a lucky charm, kind of like carrying a cross to ward off evil. There are many people that wear the medals of saints around their necks, thinking that somehow wearing the medal of this particular saint is going to somehow bring some kind of provision or guidance or protection. I once read about a soldier in World War II that, like many soldiers did, whether they were people of faith or not, would often go to the chapel services that the chaplain would have before they went into a big battle. And this one chaplain was dispensing little crucifixes if the men wanted one. And this one soldier, who did not have a religious background, took it and stuck it in his pocket. They got into the heat of the battle. I mean, bombs are going off everywhere, and he's running for his life. He dives into a foxhole, and he turns to his buddy and says, "How do you work this thing?" I mean, you know, it's like somehow it's some kind of a lucky charm to carry in your pocket, a four-leaf clover. I was reading one book some years ago that mentioned that there was a toy manufacturer that was talking about making a God doll. And they had come up with kind of a schematic that this would be an older man with gray hair and a long white beard. He would have a colorful robe with all kinds of animals kind of represented on the robe. And apparently there was a talk show host in the city of Chicago who heard about the God doll and said he had an even better idea. Why not just issue a lump of clay to every child and let them create the God that they want in their own image? Let everybody kind of just make their own. Well, that's the very thing we're not to be doing. Over in Habakkuk, if you'd like to turn there, please feel free. In Habakkuk chapter 2, verses 18, it's really tucked in there between these little short books. It's right after the book of Nahum and right before the book of Zephaniah. Habakkuk chapter 2. Last week we quoted Jeremiah in this regard. Then Habakkuk, the prophet, says this in verses 18 through 20. "What profit is the idol when its maker has carved it? Or an image, a teacher of falsehood? For its maker trusts in his own handiwork when he fashions speechless idols. Woe to him who says to a piece of wood, 'Awake,' or to a dumb stone, 'Arise,' and that is your teacher? Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, and there's no breath at all inside of it. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him." So the thing about images is they inevitably become limiting, obscuring, localizing the one true God. Always somehow detracting from his greatness. And so the only way we maintain a proper image in our focus on worship is to keep going to just what the Word tells us about God. I referred to Acts chapter 17 a few moments ago in Paul's speech before the Athenians. He said this in verse 29 of Acts 17, "Being then the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and thought of man, or by the human design and skill of man, or out of the imagination of man, or out of the art and device of man. Another reason it is forbidden is because of the incarnation. And I'm just going to read to you three verses in this regard, or three texts. And the first one is John 14, verses 7 through 9. Jesus says, "If you had known me, you would have known my Father also. From now on, you know him and have seen him." Wait, I thought God was not someone you could see. Philip said to him, "Lord, show us the Father, and it's enough for us." Jesus said to him, "Have I been with you so long, and yet you have not come to know me, Philip? He who has seen me has seen the Father. How do you say, 'Show us the Father'?" So we do see God physically in one way, and that's in the person of his Son, Jesus Christ. Which is what prompts Paul to say in writing to the Colossians, in Colossians chapter 1, verse 15, speaking of Jesus, "He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation." And then a third text in relationship to the incarnation would be in Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 through 3. God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many portions and in many ways, in these last days has spoken to us in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world. And he is the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his nature, and upholds all things by the word of his power. When he had made purification of sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. So the declaration of the New Testament is, you want to see God the Father? You look at his Son. That's the only physical representation that we're permitted to have. I want to come back to that in just a moment. But the other reason why it is forbidden, in going back to the Exodus 20 passage, is he says, "For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God." In fact, a few chapters later in Exodus chapter 34, verse 14, it states, "For you shall not worship any other God, for the Lord, whose name is jealous, is a jealous God." And by the way, can I make a recommendation to you? I can't remember how many years ago it was. I attended one of these national pastors' conferences, the Together for the Gospel, and R.C. Sproul gave a message on the jealousy of God, which is the best message I've heard on this topic in my entire life. And so if you can go online and find R.C. Sproul's message at Together for the Gospel on the jealousy of God, it'll blow your socks off. It is just a great, great message. But of course, there are two types of jealousy. There is the jealousy that springs from pride and envy, and that is an evil kind of jealousy. But then there's the other kind of jealousy that is the zeal to protect a love relationship, and certainly to correct it when it's violated. What husband or wife who really loves their spouse is unaffected by their promiscuity or their unfaithfulness? I mean, there's no such thing. I mean, if you really love someone, if they were to be unfaithful, that would bring about a certain jealous response, and one that you wouldn't want to live with. God is described as being jealous for our affection and our reverence and our trust and our praise. And that's why the marriage relationship is a fitting analogy for this. And that's why so frequently in the Old Testament, as we go through the history of Israel falling away and coming back and falling away and coming back, repeatedly the prophets describe Israel as being adulterous, as being the unfaithful spouse. The English poet and Christian minister, John Donne, once wrote this line, if thou carest not who I love, then thou lovest not me. If thou carest not who I love, then thou lovest not me. And that's what God is saying. I mean, He loves us. He wants to maintain a relationship of fidelity and love and a covenant relationship with us. And He's jealous for that if we do something to stain it or tarnish it or even reject it. I have mentioned on previous messages one of my favorite professors in seminary. He taught me Hebrew and actually made it fun. Walt Kaiser, he stated about God's jealousy that God is stirred up and provoked against whatever hinders the enjoyment of that which He loves and desires. The greatest insult that can be done against love, in this case God's love for us, His people, is to slight it and to embrace a lesser, more base love. And then there's the warning that comes in Exodus chapter 20 about those who violate this commandment. And that's the judgment of God visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children of the third and fourth generations of those who hate me. That is, that there are consequences when people live sinfully and in disobedience to God in any family or any culture. The inevitable consequences are it'll affect the succeeding generations. That's why whenever we read or hear on the news about someone who's in prison for sexual abuse, I don't know the exact statistics, but I just know the majority of the time, people who have abused others that way were abused that way themselves as they were children. That people who are abused as children grow up and abuse other children. And you could say it about alcoholism, you could say it about all kinds of vices and sins, that when people give themselves over to this, it's not that some succeeding generation is going to be innocent and pay the price for that. No. In fact, I think to keep the proper balance on this, we need to keep in mind Deuteronomy 24, where it states, "Fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor children put to death for their fathers. Each is to die for his own sin." So there's an individual culpability, but what is it that makes a person prone to be engaged in certain kinds of sinful behavior? Well, a lot of times it's behavior that's passed down through the family. I don't want to just pick on this one family, but they've been so public. Why do they talk about the curse of the Kennedy family? Why were all of his boys so promiscuous? Because the father lived this incredibly promiscuous life. It was obviously like father, like son. And I haven't followed the succeeding generations, but there's an impact of how we live. And I always thought one of the most graphic illustrations of this was in a book that came out years ago called The Cross and the Flag. And it decided to follow the posterity of two people who had lived in New York State. And the first man, his name was Max Jukes, lived in the state of New York. He was an unbeliever. He married a woman of like character. And from that union came 1,029 descendants. From those 1,029 descendants, 300 died prematurely, 100 were sent to the penitentiary for an average of 13 years each, 190 were public prostitutes, 100 were alcoholics. They calculated at the time that that family, through its multiple generations, had cost the state of New York $1.25 million. Another resident of New York, Jonathan Edwards. He believed in God and was a committed Christian. He married a woman of like character. From that union, 729 descendants were studied. 300 became Christian ministers, 65 college professors, 13 presidents of universities, 60 became good best-selling authors, 3 U.S. congressmen, and 1 vice president of the United States. There's a certain pattern that's established, which succeeding generations follow. But thanks be to the grace of God, because what was going on in my family the last few generations came to a reversal with me, because I came to know Christ as a young man. And my habits and my family did not follow in the footsteps of my predecessors, where there was quite a bit of alcoholism. But he goes on to say that, yes, God does judge, especially those who hate him, but he also says that God is merciful. He's jealous, he's just, and he's gracious. Now, I don't want to conclude without touching on the third question: what is the role of art in worship? Man is created in the image of God. And part of God's image that I believe is emblazoned upon us as human beings is that just as God is creative, he created the world and the universe, every plant, animal, everything we see around us, he created. And humankind bears that creative desire and ability. And in fact, artistry is commended in the Old Testament. If you look at Exodus chapter 31, just a few chapters over from Exodus 20, in Exodus 31, they're preparing to build the tabernacle, the tent that moved around with the people of Israel as a place of worship. And starting in verse 1 of Exodus 31, "Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, See, I have called by name Bezalel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah, and I have filled him with the Spirit of God and wisdom and understanding and knowledge and in all kinds of craftsmanship, to make artistic designs for work in gold and silver and in bronze, and the cutting of stones for settings, and in the carving of wood, that he may work in all kinds of craftsmanship." Turn back to Exodus chapter 25. I just want to snatch this one little description of some of the things they were making for the tabernacle. Verse 17, "And you shall make a mercy seat of pure gold, 2.5 cubits long and 1.5 cubits wide. And you shall make 2 cherubim of gold, make them of hammered work at the 2 ends of the mercy seat. Make 1 cherub at one end and 1 at the other. You shall make the cherubim of one piece with the mercy seat at its 2 ends. And it talks about the wings hovering over the mercy seat. And if you have time and want to read the more elaborate description, the temple was one ornate place with all kinds of artistic representations of flowers, of vines, of fruit, colors in the curtain that hung before the Holy of Holies that represented earth and sky and sea. And you may think, well, is that not contradicting what we're saying? No. These were built as representations of God's creative work in the world, but they were never to become objects, and they never used them as objects of worship. So we should expect that man's going to continue to demonstrate and exhibit this creativity in all kinds of artistic ways, because our God is such a creative God. But the main principle here is there is a difference between objects of worship and representations of worship. I'm going to close and answer 3 questions briefly. Is it wrong to have pictures of God the Father? I believe, yes, it is wrong to have some physical image likeness of God the Father. I couldn't pass it up because it's world famous. When Priscilla and I were in Rome some years ago, of course, we went to the Vatican and walked for 50 miles through the hallways to get to the Sistine Chapel. We looked up, and I thought, you know, Michelangelo was wrong to do that. No wonder people think God is old with white hair and a long gray beard, because that's the way Michelangelo painted him on the ceiling. God's reaching out to Adam, and he's an old man with white hair and a gray beard. I think that violates the second commandment, making an image of God who is a spirit. Second question, is it wrong to have ornamentation and artistic expressions of nature No. And I think stained glass windows that depict certain events in the Christian church, we have all kinds of Christian symbols, whether it's a dove or an anchor or a cross or an Alpha Omega, or there's all kinds of things that are symbolic of certain aspects of our Christian faith. It's not wrong to have that as ornamentation and for artistic expression, as long as it doesn't become the object of worship. Third question, is it wrong to have pictures of Jesus? I didn't know I'd ever be bold enough to ever say this in public, and this is actually going to be on the web. As much as I revere and respect him, I disagree with J.I. Packer. Dr. Packer thinks it is a violation of the Second Commandment to even have pictures of Jesus in children's curriculum. The fact is, God saw fit to allow the second person of the Godhead to take on physical form and walk this earth as a man. So we know he represents a physical portrayal and image as the God-man, Jesus of Nazareth. So I do not believe it is wrong to have artistic depictions of Jesus. Now, do I like it? No, I don't. I went to see the Son of God movie here a few months ago. I think I made mention of it already. And when he came walking on the Sea of Galilee, you know, and the wind's blowing, and he looks like he just stepped out of GQ, and flowing hair, and everything just looked so in place. He looked more like a model off the runway than he did a rugged carpenter in the first century. I've never seen a movie yet where you see Jesus' face that I really liked the way it came across. But do I think it's sin and a violation of the commandment? No, I just don't prefer it. I'm happy that our children's curriculum has some depiction of Jesus in it. But I love the way the old movie Ben-Hur did it. Remember how Ben-Hur did it? Whenever Jesus appears, you never saw his face. When he was preaching the Sermon on the Mount, you saw it from behind, standing in front of a throng of people. When he kneels down to give the water to Ben-Hur, you see his hand. I think there's a glow. But anyway, you see his hand go forth and give the cup of water. And then one time Charlton Heston looks in his face. You never see Jesus' face. I think that's preferable. The church has struggled with this through history. Back in the 4th century, there was a bishop by the name of Epiphanius who was a bishop in Cyprus, where Rupin is from, and he was visiting the churches, and the church historians tell us that he visited a certain church when he was over in Palestine, and he discovered a curtain hanging in the church that had a depiction of Jesus on it, and he tore it down. He was shocked that they would have some representation of Jesus at all. So he tore it down, and they kind of grumbled and said, well, you know, now we don't have a curtain. So he found one and sent them a replacement that was very nice. Fast forward to the 8th century, there was a Greek father, John of Damascus, who argued that since God had become flesh, it was not improper to represent or depict what is visible in God, that is the incarnate Son. But where the danger comes, and Thomas Aquinas observed this, he said, men are more easily moved by what they see than by what they hear or read. And this is where there is a struggle for the Christian church for us to stay word-centered and rely mainly on this book for our motivation and for our focus on worship. I was talking with someone here at the chapel just recently that was visiting another church, and they literally had smoke billowing out from the stage and lights and with the worship singing, and they're creating an atmosphere where it's appealing to people's senses. And if we're not careful, we can begin to localize, to diminish, and we can start to think that somehow that is to be the focal point of our worship. I have been in many cathedrals in Europe, and I've been in Greek Orthodox churches in Hungary, in Serbia, in Belarus, in Moscow, and I've gone in there. You stand in their services. You don't sit in an Orthodox service. You stand the entire time. It gets a little tiring, actually. I only stayed 30 minutes. But watching these people with these icons and this gold and silver and these pictures of Mary and of Jesus and the disciples and the saints, and people going up to them and kissing them and touching them and writing prayer things and sticking them in, and I've seen women go up to statues and kiss the feet of Mary and cry and weep and just pray so fervently. And I don't want to mock them. I feel for these people. They fervently, urgently need something from God. And we're told to call on Him. But we don't go to some marble statue and kiss the feet of a statue. That's violating the first and second commandment. Martin Luther tackled this issue. And his appeal was, His word is to be there. This is to give us light and guidance. Without His word, all is idolatry and lies, however devout it may seem and however beautiful it may appear. And many people say, well, no, we're not intending to worship it. This is just to help us worship God. But there is a slippery slope between some physical setting or image helping us to worship God and actually crowding in and becoming the object of our worship. I respectfully disagree with my elder friends in their two churches that are taking down the stained glass windows. I mean, I'm not upset they do it. It's their church. But if we bought a building and I had a stained glass window with Jesus as a depiction on there, I probably could live with it. I wouldn't be that bothered by it. But what goes on in our hearts, of course, is another issue. Our image of God has got to be shaped only by the Scriptures.